Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games as well. And I oftentimes make them with a multi-project contributor, Coyote, who is here with us. Hello.
Hi, I'm Coyote. I am a game writer and editor, and I work with Craig a lot. Love working with Craig, and I love recording with Jess. So
yay.
Here I am.
Thanks, Coyote, for coming on. We're so excited. I've been talking about how excited I am for this topic. Craig, do you want to introduce the topic? Or do you want me to?
I think you should. This is definitely, we have a system of how we do this and everything, but we're going to, every so often we have to mix it up. This one, Jess, why don't you tell us what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, today we are talking, and specifically why Craig is saying, maybe let Jess handle this one. Today we're going to be talking about the subgenre of feminine horror. So feminine horror can relate to a lot of different things. It's a huge subgenre in the broader horror genre in general, in films, in TV shows, in video games, and of course, in tabletop role-playing games. There's several very popular role-playing games specifically about feminine horror, and I'm sure we will enumerate them. Coyote, I want to throw it over to you. Why did you choose this topic beyond possibly the obvious that you are a feminine person?
Yeah. It is one of my favorite genres to write in, to explore in different forms of media. Everything I do, I think in some way ends up relating a little bit back to it. So yeah, I thought like we should talk about it. A lot of people seem to not really know what it is, or you know, have a misconception that just because it's called feminine horror means that people who aren't feminine or who aren't women can't enjoy it. So I thought we would talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great specifically for non-women to experience feminine horror. And I actually think it can sometimes be a little bit more horrific for non-women to play feminine horror games or watch feminine horror movies. I'm thinking specifically about the movie Obsession that
yes.
recently came out. Very deeply a feminine horror movie. And the people that I know who have been the most disturbed by that movie have been cis straight men. And they should have been. It should
right,
be horrifying
yeah.
for them.
For sure, but, yeah.
And I yeah. think the key point with that particular segment of the audience, and it can apply to RPG playing as well, is that that segment of the audience was not prepared, like had no resources to call upon to address something that they have not, you know, experienced in a meaningful way. Even if they have been told stories, you know, we've talked about plenty of times, every woman, every femme presenting person has their stories. And if you know, like it's very easy for me as such a straight dude to just not be aware of a lot of stuff unless female friends or family members open up to me directly about it, or I happen upon just the right Reddit thread that doesn't get shut down because of, you know, a-holes. So I'm interested to hear what all of you have to say, because I haven't had the opportunity to play much in the way of feminine horror. Got very close to playing Bluebeard's Bride once, and then it fell apart.
Well, I'm sure that you have experience, like you've been at least an observer of some feminine horror games and or movies, even Alien,
oh, yeah,
for example.
Absolutely.
And some of my favorite feminine horror movies are written and directed by men, and I find mm-hmm. that so fascinating. I don't know why. I don't know the psychology behind that, but it's a fascinating thing to think about. So yeah, definitely to echo what Coyote said, like this is not something I think everybody should like not feel like they can, how am I going to say this? No one should feel like they shouldn't be a part of this genre, because literally
right.
everyone in the world knows a woman and should be connected to their experiences, and it can be really fun.
Yeah, exactly.
And enlightening in many cases.
So what should we do when we are, like, especially if we have a group of mixed gender people at our table, what are some tips that we have for GMing a feminine horror game?
So one of the things that I like to do when bringing up to a mixed gender group of like, hey, I would like to really play this game, it's feminine horror, is sort of framing it as an opportunity to sate curiosity and to really be inhabiting a role that you're not used to, sort of like a role-playing challenge. And, you know, just really playing up the aspect of, well, you know, like, this isn't something that you've encountered before. It's new. So it's going to be exciting. It's going to be fun. And it may help you connect a little better with the femme people in your life and the people who love them and who have maybe gone through these things with them. Another thing I bring up is that, like, kind of like you mentioned earlier, feminine horror is everywhere. And a lot of times, at least popular feminine horror has been written or conceived of by men. Mm-hmm. Stephen King's Carrie is feminine horror, and he like really hit the nail on the head on some parts of that book and movies. Nat Cassidy is a very, you know, well-known horror author whose book Mary, I think, has won some awards. And for the longest time, I thought Nat Cassidy was a woman because he really, you know, dug into that experience. And at the end acknowledgments of the book, he credits all the women that he has grown up with and been close to. And, you know, just talked about how listening to their experiences sort of, you know, gave him this perspective of, you know, something that's a little bit alien, but maybe shouldn't be because we're all humans. And then that itself became part of the horror. So I always like to get people interested by just reassuring them, because what I find most often is that people aren't like, well, this is feminine horror, so it's stupid and I don't want to play it. Most of the time what I come across are people who are concerned, who are like, hey, I don't want to, you know, step into a space where maybe I don't belong, or, you know, do it wrong, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And just reminding them that, like, feminine horror, despite its name, is a human experience. And, you know, that is how I kind of approach it when dealing with mixed gender groups.
Yeah, I think it's important to know some of those themes that come up too if someone isn't like super knowledgeable about the genre itself. And we had enumerated them a little bit. That's the second time I've used the word enumerated. Everyone take a drink.
It's a good
enumerated
word.
So in our email thread, we talked about it, exploring themes of bodily autonomy, societal expectations, trauma, rage. Whereas I think a lot of like the thing about specifically feminine horror is the idea that your body is not your own, whether that's through a patriarchal control of who you are and what you should be in society, or whether it is the idea that you can grow a life inside of you. Like those things, I think, really come to play. And now, especially, I think more recently, this idea and also like the whole idea of growing old and mm-hmm. changing and not conforming to those standards, I think is a special kind. I know like everybody gets old, obviously, but I think it's a special kind of horror for women. Our bodies and AFAB people, our bodies change so much more dramatically, I feel, through puberty and through old age than men do or assigned male at birth people do. I'm not really sure about the experiences of trans people and their and how menopause affects them. So but I know for if you're a cis woman, menopause is going to really really change your body, and pregnancy will really really change your body too, no matter who you are. And those things can be like that's really where the key of that horror is. And I think if you tell your gaming group like, hey, these are the things that this game will cover, this is integral to this, and the idea of being controlled, and that you really, I mean, being a woman is pretty scary in society. By nature, we tend to be smaller, weaker, less muscle mass. There's far less physical power we have. So you can't just fight your way out of everything.
For sure.
And I think that those are like really impressing upon your players that, hey, this is about that struggle and it's going to be really uncomfortable. That's going to help them get into the mindset. And then you got to talk about your safety tools.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Feminine horror is something where requiring safety tools. But yeah, in addition to just, you know, the idea that you're going to embody a character that may be, you know, physically smaller and all these things that most AFAB people, etc., tend to be, there's also, I think, a theme of ignorance, because societally, there is so much about women's bodies that we simply don't know because no one bothered to figure it out. Women weren't part of, you know, a lot of medical testing when it came to medications until like either the late 90s or early 2000s.
Yeah.
Which is insane because yeah. Women were reporting, you know, all these side effects, and doctors for decades were saying, oh, no, that doesn't exist. You're just being hysterical. That's not happening. And then it's like, well, you didn't know. You had no idea. And, you know, now we're finding out that, yeah, these things were actually happening. So it's the psychological aspect, too, of dismissal and gaslighting and not only not being able to trust the people around you, but maybe not being able to trust yourself and your own read on the situation.
Yes.
That is a deeply uncomfortable part of games like Bluebeard's Bride, mm-hmm. Where the player's perspective is filtered through some sort of like canonical aspects of femininity, traditional femininity, I should say traditional European femininity, mm-hmm. Where you're not quite sure as any one facet of yourself if you are reading that situation correctly, if what you're doing is the right thing, and if you should even listen to the parts of yourself that are, you know, calling to you and telling you what to do. So I really like that aspect of it too. And I do think that's one of the ones that also caused people to be very uncomfortable during the game.
Yeah. And they're unavoidable. Like you could play a role-playing game and avoid all those topics, but you can't play a feminine horror game and avoid those topics.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I think some specific safety tools that should be obviously having the conversation ahead of time with your players, making sure everyone's on board with playing this kind of game. But you have to really be, especially if you play Bluebeard's Bride, like really, you're all trying to fuck with one person, basically.
Yes.
It can be very, that can be very, very difficult for that person. You really have to be in tune with the people at your table. I would really recommend not playing your first ever feminine horror game online. I think you should probably be in a physical table with people, looking at them and reading their body language and
right,
all of
getting
that.
Getting the vibe.
See, this might be a little controversial, but I think having a tool like an X card is not the best in service of this type of game. I think stopping and completely avoiding a topic as it comes up in the game is not the first tool that I would reach for if I was GMing a game like this. I think a stop and talk, stop and debrief is a tool that I would reach for first.
Right, yeah. To try to preserve the experience for what it is meant to be. Yeah,
exactly. I'm not saying that, like, obviously use whatever tools you're going to use at your table, but I think some of these games require a little bit more of an open conversation. But I think if you brief ahead of time, you're going to have less of a chance that you're going to encounter something that people are going to not want to touch at the table, because people are going to come into that and not take it over the top, make it too much. And then at the end, I feel like we don't talk a lot about aftercare in games.
Right,
we talk a lot about like pre-care. Do you have any tips for like the aftercare of, once you've experienced something horrific at the table that you were supposed to experience?
Yeah, I love TTRPG pillow talk. Like I love to kind of like sit there and talk about what did we just experience. Something that I do a lot is Stars and Wishes. It frames it positively a lot of the time, but it also kind of leaves room to say like, man, like I really did enjoy this game, but I wish that, you know, we had maybe done this a little bit differently. And then allowing players to talk about, okay, well, why do you feel that way? Why, you know, what was your experience with it? And sometimes just asking an individual player like, hey, what was your experience with this, opens up a broader conversation where other players now feel comfortable or empowered to chime in and be like, huh, that's interesting. Like I didn't see it that way. Or, oh yeah, I felt that too. And give their own perspective on it and kind of just have like this really nice discussion where people get to talk about their feelings in a structured way, because I do feel like a lot of people, when they're just asked, how do you feel? Like it's such a broad, like non-focused question that it can like feel like, oh, I'm being put on the spot. And then like, I don't know, like I have myriad feelings. I contain multitudes. but like if you say, okay, for example, just Stars and Wishes, and then pick something that they brought up specifically and sort of open with that, it kind of just like opens the door. Like it lets people sort of talk about what they experienced and how that felt for them, and maybe what, you know, you should do next time, or maybe avoid in the future. I love conversations like that. I find them really intimate in a way that, if I'm a GM, allows me to deeply connect with my players and get to know them on a new level of oh, this is what they're coming to the table for, or this is what they're not coming to the table for. So yeah, I love a nice little round table pillow talk afterwards.
Yeah, that's great. I love using the Stars and Wishes like that. I think even as a GM, you could prepare ahead of time, sort of like a book club discussion style question.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you get a book and it has the questions in the back.
Oh, I love that. I love that. That would be fun.
And if the purpose of you playing this game is to sort of be educative, having those kinds of discussion questions could be within your purview as a GM or as the host or facilitator, giving time for everybody to like, okay, what did we learn? What are your thoughts? What are you going to do next? How does this do that? But particularly taking care so that if you have a group of mixed gender people, that you are leaving room for the women at your table to talk more than
for
the
men. Sure.
Yeah. Sorry, dudes, you tend to grab a lot of the conversation sometimes, even when it's not really about you. Of course, giving them time to talk, but making sure that the conversation is equal. I think a book club discussion is another great safety tool too. It does really help you debrief and unpack.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea of preparing, you know, ahead of time, you know, some questions that, you know, everybody can draw from and I also like the idea, I don't know if this is what you meant, but of like giving them to the players ahead of time so they can think about them.
I like that too. I was not thinking about that, but I love the idea of giving it to them in advance, because that's going to prime them as well to be better players, because they'll be thinking about like, how can I answer, if I have a question, like, how does this do this in the game? Or like, how is this theme brought up? I'm going to be more as a player trying to bring that theme up in the game. I know that that's just going to be me as a person. I think that's going to make my gaming experience a little bit more impactful, a little bit more thoughtful.
Yeah. And you mentioned like the X card is not maybe the first tool that you would reach for. And I agree. I will say that the last time I played Bluebeard's Bride, what the GM did that I really liked was, and I apologize because I don't know the name of the safety tool, but basically it was sort of a list of like red, yellow, green, like a traffic light list, where red was like, I don't want to see this at all. Yellow was yes, but like, let's kind of, it might have been a version of lines and veils.
Yeah.
And then green was, yep, I'm okay with these things. And there were some check boxes and like some things that you could write in. I thought that worked really well. We all turned it in prior to the game so that the GM could know like, okay, this is what I need to avoid when I'm doing my planning, or this is what they're all okay with. So I could definitely, you know, push this. I do think that one is pretty helpful.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about alliance and veil. So I'm going to look up that if it's an existing safety tool. I'm sure it's somewhere.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I think finally, like in terms of safety tools, this is also something you have to prep as a GM within your game, is yes, there's like the feminine horror side, but as we mentioned, there's also the feminine rage side. There is the Carrie burning everything down with her brain side of things.
Yes.
And whether or not that's actually incorporated in the scope of the game, it can be really impactful on people to just like, again, if I'm a woman, I already have to experience these things in real life. Maybe I do want that moment of catharsis to like win, but that's not necessarily going to be in the scope of the game. If you don't have that packed in within the scope of your game, giving your players a catharsis, even if it's not a completely happy ending, it doesn't have to be a happy ending.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Midsummer's
not a happy ending.
Midsummer's not a happy ending. You know.
Oh, I love Midsummer. And we're right around the midsummer solstice. So.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Tropical.
Oh.
Just a note from the researcher over here. There's the consent in gaming free PDF from Monte Cook Games that might be what you were talking about, Coyote. It's a big list with checkboxes and spots where you can fill stuff in. It's a free PDF. You can get it at Monte Cook Games, and I'm sure that it's probably been plopped onto various other websites as well.
Awesome.
Since
thank
it
you.
Is free.
Yeah. But yeah, then after your game, if you don't have that moment of like power, maybe have something at the end that will make people feel empowered again.
Yeah.
Go do something fun. Go
to a rage room.
Yeah. Do something that's gonna make you.
What is that?
You don't know what a rage room is?
Is it like a mosh pit just put into a room?
kind of. So they give like. you sign a waiver, and then. Sure. They give you some protective gear, hopefully, and some weapons, hopefully. And you get to go smash stuff. Like they'll get, you know, like they just have like a bunch of stuff, like plates, vases.
Oh, wow.
Like all kinds that you can just like use a bat to smash and just get your rage out.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Anyway.
Play some heavy metal music. You know, there's all sorts of stuff you could do.
Baseball bat and a protective eyewear versus five tables of breakables.
Yes. It's a good time.
Wow.
But I mean, for me, again, like I went and I saw Obsession with my husband, and afterwards, like the best thing was to just like take a walk and talk about the movie after. Like, yeah. That was fucked up. That was a great movie. Let's tell everyone to go watch it. And then like just having the conversation, I think does a lot. So a quick note here, Coyote, I want to ask you, since you're probably the person who's played Bluebeard's Bride the most recently out of the two of us. As a facility, because that's GM-less game.
Right. Well, no, actually, you have someone who is sort of telling you what is happening around you, And then you have one person who is playing the bride, who is Bluebeard's latest bride. And then all of the other players are playing facets of that bride that embody sort of traditional European feminine archetypes, like the mother, the fatale, you know, the angel. Our GM was very good at just kind of being like, okay, these are the rooms that you're finding. And, you know, there was a little bit of, not necessarily combat, but some aggressive ghostly encounters and things like that. It's not entirely GM-less, I would say.
GM-less in a very traditional sense.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of the horror that is being inflicted, a lot of the horror is coming from the players themselves.
Oh, 100%. The call is coming from inside the house.
But when you are playing a game like this, how do you, as a player and also as a GM, as a facilitator or GM, how do you know when the line is being crossed? Because I think that there is a line. And there's a line sure. in a horror. There's lines in horror movies, too, that we yeah. don't cross. How do we ensure that no one is overstepping? When do we know when we're designing a game, like to run, like a session to run, how do we know what's going too far?
Yeah, it is definitely something that is difficult in, I think, most horror games, but especially in feminine horror, because you are reaching so deep into the psyche and pulling oftentimes even, you know, accidentally or inadvertently from people's very real experiences. You have people at the table who may have gone through some of these things, and we are possibly dredging up that trauma in a way that a player may not be prepared for. That is one of the reasons that I like the Monte Cook safety tool that we talked about earlier, and having that ahead of time as a facilitator to be able to know, like, for sure we are not going to talk about these things. Or if, you know, you see something that's on the red list and you're like, this is kind of central to what we're doing, I need to talk with this player a little bit before the game to make sure that we're on the same page. But even doing that and even having the best of intentions, mm-hmm. occasionally you can cross a line. And in my opinion, the best way to deal with that, the ideal way to deal with that is, ideally your player will say, maybe pull something like the X card and be like, super not okay with that. And you get to talk about it and then reverse course if need be, or just make the accommodations necessary in the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm also a big fan of taking a break. And, you know, it doesn't have to break the mood. I think oftentimes that's what we worry about, right? Like that we're going to lose momentum, that the atmosphere at the table is going to change too drastically for us to get back into it. There are ways to preserve atmosphere without, you know, like while you're on a break. But one of the tenets of horror in general is like, you don't just go full tilt all the time. You give your audience something like really scary or really emotional to work through or whatever it is, and then you pull back. Mm-hmm. And then you ramp it back up and then you pull back. And right. sometimes what you need, you know, if you cross a line, is just to pull back for a little bit and take a break, have a conversation. In the case where your player doesn't speak up, that is a lot harder. You know, because then you're doing damage control from after the fact and the feelings have already been hurt. That is much more difficult. And I would love thoughts on that, because all I, you know, can come up with is just being like, oh, sorry. And, you know,
I think admitting that not every subject is appropriate for a role-playing game.
For sure. Yeah.
In general, like, a TTRPG doesn't need to be able to handle every single topic
It just doesn't. It happens.
It feels like to me that, like, harkening back to something Jess said, that being in the same physical space might help the GM or facilititator to notice, like, oh, this person is kind of pulling away from the table, drawing inward, like, clearly looking nervous, and like more so than just what might have been happening at the table. If you see somebody that really kind of starts to feel like they want to run.
Yeah. And even if you're
and that might be better in person.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was just going to build on that, because and even if you're not very good at that type of thing, like, a lot of players and facilitators, GMs, etc., are neurodivergent. So even if you're not good at reading the room, there are sort of ways to get better at that. If you're going to be, you know, in a position where you kind of do need to do a little bit of a vibe check every so often, there are lots of resources out there for, you know, learning a little bit more about body language and, you know, just kind of ways to read people. And I highly recommend taking a look at some of those if you are someone who struggles with any of those things. And that way, you know, that is a great way to help make sure that your game keeps running smoothly and that everybody is doing okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the fun side of this as well. The reasons why and the things that are really fun to add into your game. This can kind of slide over into the designing a game like this side of things. What are the moments and scenes that are, like, integral to a feminine horror game?
Oh, man. I think definitely, like you mentioned earlier, the subject of autonomy, bodily autonomy, you know, getting to make decisions about your own life, even. I think a lot of times when there is, in feminine horror, there's some type of scene or theme of somebody who is either part of the patriarchy or who has been harmed by it and sort of internalized it, is trying to keep like very tight control over you. And I do think it is fun sometimes to explore the internalized misogyny too, of like feeling like you have a femme, female, AFAB character you can trust, like an NPC. And then finding that, oh no, like, the system affects everybody.
Oh no, the call's coming from inside the house sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. I think that's a really good one. It really throws people off. It's great.
How can we gamify that? Like, what can we do? Like, maybe we know some good games that, like, really gamify that well, have a good mechanic for it, or what are some of our ideas to gamify this idea of the patriarchal control?
So not to always bring up Bluebeard's Bride, because there's another game that I'm
it's the number one it's in one this
of
genre.
Yeah, it's like
the
seminal but I'm also thinking a little bit of another game called Women Are Werewolves.
Yes.
Have you played that one?
I have. Yeah.
So good. And it gives special consideration to non-binary people and trans people. So good. Mm-hmm. But that one is kind of loose on mechanics. So I am going back to Bluebeard's Bride. I think one of the really cool things in Bluebeard's Bride is that it is very, like, it tells you up front, you are affected by social constructs, and you know, these like in the playbooks they'll say, like, these are kind of like the personality of the bride, and this is what you would do, and this is, you know, kind of what you would struggle to do, not wouldn't, but you would struggle to do this because of your upbringing and you know, these things. And it really lays it out for players who may not have experience with that. And without going into too much detail and like writing a whole book on it, for each playbook, I think that is a great way to help enforce that dynamic of, you know, having it written down that, you know, this is sort of what you're dealing with and what you've been raised to believe, and this is where you are with that, which then makes playbooks like the Fatale, who still does, you know, have to work within patriarchy to some extent, but who also is comfortable breaking some of that or using that to empower herself. Like, I just love when things are kind of spelled out, you know, for players who may not otherwise get it. Big fan of that.
Yeah, I think if you're designing a game like this, having a strict limit or definition of what is acceptable for this character to do and what it would mean to break that, I think is huge. Really, mm-hmm. Especially if it's a different setting. So I have a game called Aqua Tofana coming out very soon. Where you are in a very, very specific setting. You are in the 1600s Italy, and you are a woman. There are very strict things that you can and cannot do, and the game is about what you have to sacrifice every time you break those expectations. And I think having the here is what's acceptable, especially for the male players at your table, like.
Mm-hmm.
These are the guidelines, don't break them. And then maybe even adding some consequences to that in your game. I don't know what that would look like necessarily. There's all sorts of ways you can add consequences to your game.
Sure.
all sorts. It depends on your style of game, I guess.
Yes. Yep. And the time period that you're going to set it in. And, you know, if you are doing something like Aqua Tofana that has a historical basis, you know, you've got plenty to draw from because it already exists. your game sounds super intriguing. I'm very interested in that.
Aqua Tofana. For it. Yeah.
Aqua Tofana, for people who don't know, do you want to talk about what Aqua Tofana is, like the actual thing that it was?
Sure. Yeah. Aqua Tofana was a poison that women specifically in this region of Italy we're using. The actual recipe is not quite known, but what it would do is one dose would induce symptoms of feeling like you have a flu. You're like not feeling great. Second dose, you're getting worse. Like this illness is developing. And this could mimic all sorts of diseases that were affecting people in the Renaissance, the Baroque period. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of diseases that would start with a fever and general malaise and then begin to affect your entire body. And by the third dose, you were basically bedridden. Nothing would be helping you. Obviously, you could do anything. And then by the fourth dose, you'd be dead. That was the legend behind it. And because it mimicked natural diseases so well, the idea that it was a poison, because it wasn't just like suddenly you're throwing up, you know, it helped kind of give the women who were dosing their husbands specifically with this a little bit more of a cover. And then also, because it's your husband, he's sick, you are going to be the one who's taking care of him, and you're the one who's going to be giving him his food and his water and obviously his poison. So it was a really poisoning ring. Women were selling this to other women in the form of a Mana de Saint Nicholas. So they would have these bottles and it would be like, oh, this is your Mana de Saint Nicholas. And it was like a religious thing. And that would contain the Aqua Tofana, and that's how they would sell it and share it. This ring ended with an unknown amount of people being killed in the hundreds, and also with, I think it was, I can't remember exactly how many women were executed for this, but it was named after Giulia Tofana, who was the ringleader of this poisoning ring.
Yeah.
And famously, Mozart believed that
he was killed with Aku Chofada. He said so, even though that is up for debate.
Yeah, and there's just so much cool stuff to delve into with that. A lot of times it was a way to, it was the only way in that time yes. period to get rid of an abusive husband.
Exactly. There was no divorce back then. You couldn't divorce. You could either run away and then be a wanton woman and not be able to exist in the confines of society anymore, which could be a death sentence because women also didn't really work. And it would be very dangerous to do so, to step out like that. You could join a convent, also not a particularly great option for women in the day. Yeah. Or you could simply wait for your husband to die faster or slower. Those were your options. Yeah. And then what would happen to a lot of these women after their husbands were dead, the in-laws would sometimes accuse the women of killing their husbands because it had started becoming known that this poisoning was happening. And then the women, especially if they wanted to remarry somebody else, they'd be like, oh, my in-laws who are supposed to be protecting me after this. Any children that you had back then were the property of your husband, just like you were the property of your husband. So after your husband died, your children didn't necessarily go to you. They would go mm-hmm. to your husband's family. And sometimes men would write into their will, my children are allowed to stay in the home and my wife is allowed to stay in this home should I die, as long as she does not remarry. And that could be a goal. That could be great for the woman. Maybe she didn't want to remarry. But if that didn't exist, you would sometimes have to abandon your children with your in-laws and then go remarry somebody else because mm-hmm. your in-laws were threatening to have you killed. And then you could be under the protection of another man. Happy endings, obviously, abound.
All around.
I did a lot of real feminine horror. Yeah, I did a lot of research for the game.
It's fascinating. It really is. I'm glad you shared it.
Yeah, that's part of like the feminine horror of it all too. Like sometimes the only way to escape is via violence. And that can be, yes, cathartic, but can also be part of the horror itself. I don't want to do this. You're making me do this.
Yes.
Here's what I got.
And like, you know, just having to escape a patriarchal construct by giving in to some other element of the patriarchy in order to get any semblance of freedom. Mm-hmm. And also the catch-22 of like, the only way I'm going to get out of this is to kill this man. But then if I kill this man, I'm a murderer. That's right on my soul. And even if I'm okay with that, you know, then I may be persecuted by another patriarchal system. Right. Like the no win situation there is another part of the horror of like, I'm not going to get out of this without losing something massive.
Yeah. It's like extreme. And that's, again, some of the fun of this, right? That's the fun of horror too, is being able to experience these things without having to actually experience those things. I'm reminded of the story, The Lady or the Tiger. Are you familiar?
Yes. Love that story.
It's also in a very real way a feminine horror story.
100%. Yeah.
We have the lover signaling which door to go into. We have the lady who might have to marry someone she doesn't know. There's so much going on in that story that's very good feminine horror, and this idea of like no good choice and embedding that mm-hmm. into your game. Love, great. Make it feminine by adding that form of control, those societal expectations, and you've got yourself a feminine horror game.
Can I throw a quick note while we're talking about The Lady or the Tiger? Are you aware that there is a sequel?
No.
There is a sequel because at the end of the story, I'm hoping everybody here has read that at some point in school.
Pause the podcast. Go read it. It's very short.
A choice yes. be made, but the author doesn't tell you what choice is made. Right. And so many people bug the author to say, well, hey, you can't leave us hanging because that was how at the time, when you wrote a story, you gave them an ending. And so he wrote a story that, in response to people asking him to clarify what choice the character made in the first story. And that story is exactly what you would expect from this author.
I'm not giving anything away. I want to read that. I'm going to read that as soon as we're done with this call.
I was going to mention that there is a game called The Lady and the Tiger.
Very good.
It's not a TTRPG. It is a card game, but it is very, very fun. I used to play that with my now eldest daughter. She's 18. But I used to play that with her when she was little. It's cool. It's just a fun game. If anyone out there has kids and wants to play it, it's a lot of fun.
Another aspect of feminine horror I wanted to talk about today was the idea of investigation.
Yeah.
When you're being gaslit and you don't know what to trust, investigation is one of your primary tools. And you actually see this a lot in gothic horror or that style of horror. I'm thinking about like Jane Eyre. There's investigation that occurs in the midst of all this gaslighting. In Rebecca, one of my favorite books of all time, there's this idea of trying to find that piece of evidence that proves your sanity or proves that the thing that you already know is happening. And adding that form of investigation into your game is at once a form of horror because like you don't want it to be true. You don't want to believe that your husband has a lady trapped in his attic, right? You don't want to believe that. You don't want to believe that. I mean, Rebecca is very much the same story when it comes down to it.
There's a lot of lady in the attic stories.
Jeez.
There's a lot of my husband might have killed his best wife stories.
Yeah.
Blue Reed's Bride, I think, is just the OG of that.
Yeah.
The original Blue Reed's Bride fairy tales. But having like the character can investigate, you can learn, you can find out pieces of evidence, and at once that is a triumph. I have gotten a piece of evidence. And also a horror. This evidence is horrifying. Yeah. And that is another aspect of this feminine horror that you can add, especially if you already like investigative games. I think the idea that you're constantly searching and trying to find that out, the difference being between a Sherlock Holmes and a Rebecca is the idea that you know the truth all along, and you are proving it to yourself, and it's not a truth that you like. Oh,
yes.
So good. Midsommar is another great example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's such a good movie. And you talked earlier about catharsis at the table. And I think one potential way to reach catharsis is in real life when a situation like that happens. And it doesn't have to be as dramatic as a wife in the attic or in the rose bush or whatever
Your
it is.
Boyfriend's cheating on you.
Right. So often, even if you do have all the evidence, there are going to be people who just don't believe you because they don't want to. But in a game, sometimes you can give that catharsis by being like, congratulations, you got all the pieces of the puzzle. Now you get, you know, the closure.
Yeah.
Like you know, quote unquote, as much as you can, you've won.
In the meta narrative, we know you won. Even if in the narrative, people don't believe you.
And, you know, if you are looking to have a feminine horror experience where maybe you have been gaslit a lot and you have been a victim of having like a Cassandra complex where you're constantly telling people, you know, hey, this is what's happening. And they're like, no, it isn't. It can be nice to be like, oh, look, there's a world that exists where I can win, and winning is just me being believed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is something to keep in mind too. Sometimes you can offer that.
I didn't even think about all of the feminine horror that exists in Greek myths.
Yeah.
Medea, Circe, Cassandra, literally every woman. Medusa.
Medusa is especially just so sad.
Daphne, literally every woman. Yeah. Literally every woman.
In those myths, it's like the male mortals get punished by being killed or, you know, enslaved or something. And the women, their weird twist to the story, whether it's a punishment or if it's some other aspect of the story, is often, yep, exactly. I never made the connection because I've studied Greek myth a fair bit, you know, back in college.
That fits within that topic we were talking about, like, if you have to break outside of societal expectations, and now you are no longer a woman in eyes of society.
You're a monster.
You're a monster now. You no longer fit here as a woman shape. Now you are just, those are your options.
Often too, like, I mean, sometimes it's the male gods doing this, but Hera smites women all the time because her husband raped them or coerced them or, you know, just had sex with them, whatever. And in Medusa's case, Athena is the one who punishes her for being raped by Poseidon.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like, God, there's just a lot of material there.
A ton of material. So now you have some ideas for your game.
Yeah.
Yeah, just go to Greek mythology in general. Western mythology, at least. I don't want to speak to other mythologies.
Slavic mythology, which this is a game I played at Origins this year. And I should have brought it up during the jamming section. Normally, I would avoid playing horror games, specifically feminine horror games, at a convention, let alone at a games on demand style. But I played this game called Rusalka, which is based off of the story of a Rusalka, who is
one of my favorite mythological women. Is the Rusalka
Go ahead. Do you want to talk about what a Rusalka is?
Yeah, I do.
Yes.
It is often just depending a little bit on what region you're going with. The general idea is a woman shaped creature who is usually the spirit of a woman who has been murdered by her lover or been drowned or has some connection to a body of water. And she now exists to drag other men under and lure them into her trap, which is so funny because it's like, that is obviously a monster. Or is she really evil or are they just stupid? Mm-hmm. But it's cool. Go ahead.
So this game, it's a GM-less game played with cards, very For the Queen style-esque. And everybody embodies a particular type of Rusalka. So there's like the Rusalka of sorrow, there's a Rusalka of sacrifice, Rusalka of tides. Like, there's a whole bunch of different versions you can play. And the cards have they're different phase cards as you play. But essentially every round, one person plays a mortal coming to your pond or lake or wherever where all these Rusalka are living, and they have something they want. And on your cards, there are options. You have a hand. There are options for what you are going to give or not give the mortal who has approached in return. So everyone goes around. You narrate something from your backstory as a Rusalka from when you were a mortal. You narrate something that's tied in by answering a question. And then you offer or don't offer something. Sometimes it's, I'm not giving you anything because I don't think you deserve it. Or sometimes it's, I'll give you this thing that you don't want. You know, very fairy tale style. And then at the end, after listening to all of the Rusalka talk, the mortal gets to choose whose offer they're going to take. And often this does not go well for the mortal. And what I really liked about the game is, number one, it really hits on the idea of a Slavic fairy tale. There's no happy ending. Everyone, if you go into the woods, you're doomed, basically, is the moral of any Slavic tale.
Yeah.
It's so dark. But the idea that this rage or sorrow from being a woman who's been scorned and killed, it just continues to have its ripple effect outside of the world, I think it was a really, really cool way of exploring that. And also, like, the idea of choice for the mortals each time, because sometimes the mortals were young women also. Even though the cards, like, never said whether it was a man or a woman coming, almost always, like, we would choose, like, it always felt so appropriate. Like, when it was a great way to kind of explore those themes, is what I'm saying. It's called Rusalka. Apparently, Ness and Dove is going to be doing a reprint of it. I don't know when that's coming out, but I know that the print and play exists somewhere, because that is it what does. The GM and creator said.
Yeah, it's nickwedig.itch.io/Rusalka.
Yeah, it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. And I thought it's like, if Bluebeard's Bride isn't your thing and you don't want one person to constantly be harassed, you can take turns.
You spread it around.
Yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
That sounds really cool.
And I was playing with the table of, there's only one other woman there, and the rest of them were men.
Interesting.
They did a great job.
Yeah, it's one of the cool things, and one of the brighter spots, I think, of feminine horror games in particular, because with media, there is a, like media like Obsession or Midsommar, for example, there is very little interactivity there for people who aren't femme or women, to sort of put themselves in the story and gain that empathy for, mm-hmm. you know, Nikki in Obsession or whatever, Danny in Midsommar. But when you have a game, you are stepping into a role, you are becoming a different person. And so in a way, in a controlled way, it's sort of happening to you. And I think for a lot of people who cannot otherwise, or who otherwise struggle to identify with, you know, feminine horror struggles on a personal level, gamifying it gives them the opportunity to sort of see it from that perspective and to actually be in the middle of it and have it affect them in a very meaningful, personal way.
Yeah, that's the joy of playing a TTRPG in general.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you get to embody this for a little bit of time. You get to step into someone else's shoes. There's a lot of good feminine horror LARPs that I haven't even touched on, and that's a totally different experience too.
Right, yeah.
The great thing about a LARP is, as well, is that you could play a character who's experiencing a feminine horror and nobody else in the game is.
Yeah.
You have this little solo experience, essentially, that can be really fun too. We're starting to wrap up here our conversation, Coyote, and I want to know if you have any final thoughts or anything you haven't been able to say yet that you wanted to talk about.
Just to mention another game real quick, I mentioned it very briefly earlier. There is a game called Women Are Werewolves that takes into consideration if you are a trans player, if you're a non-binary player, what that means for you. It is an exploration of family dynamics, first and foremost, from the perspective of, I am an AFAB person who is going through this transformation with my body, where my entire family structure and the world to some extent is telling me that this makes me a woman. Maybe I don't feel like I'm a woman. I am not a woman, but the world is telling me I am. And that gives a very different facet of what feminine horror can be. And I really applaud it for that. I myself am, you know, non-binary. I do use she, her pronouns, but I also use they and fey. I really loved getting to explore that facet of, you know, not only if you identify as a woman, will you deal with some of these things, but even if you don't, you may end up dealing with these things because, you know, the people who are closest to you, maybe, who should understand or who should care, maybe not understand, but even respect, mm-hmm. don't. And it is so thoroughly ingrained in you that you not only have to overcome them, but yourself. Very cool TTRPG. Just wanted to bring that up for any listeners out there who may kind of be like looking for something more in that vein.
I'm also giving a hear to that game. It's very I wouldn't even call it necessarily horror, although the idea of transformation is always going to be horrific. It doesn't have to be as horror as it sounds. It can be more Twilight if you want it to be more Twilight.
Yes, okay.
Twilight is also a lot of feminine horror.
for different reasons.
Everything's feminine horror when you're feminine. Mm-hmm.
I think the real feminine horror of Twilight was the Renesmee doll.
No one can see my face right now, but I had a visceral reaction to the Renesmee. Coyote, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about this.
Thank you for having me. I love doing this with you guys. Thank you so much.
Yes, please. Thank you and come again.
Yes.
Yes, I will. I promise. And I'm super looking forward to Aqua Tofana.
Thanks. Where can we learn more about you and your stuff?
I am on Patreon at patreon.com/coyotecrow. I am on all the socials under the name Coyote Crow. You can find me on DriveThruRPG too with different things that I've written. And that's about it. That's me.
You can find me on Blue Sky at Joska or on Discord, Joska, JAWSKA. You can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io. And Aqua Tofana is late. I know my backers are a little upset. I'm sorry, I'm constantly late for everything, but it is coming very, very shortly. It will be out this summer. And you can play a woman who is murdering her husband.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky. The website is nerdburgergames.com. You can get the games at the web store there. and you can get them also at DriveThruRPG. That's where you'll get the PDFs. But if you get the physical books, you get the PDFs too. And I will be at booth 175 at Gen Con this year.
Yeah.
Woo!
I will be running a LARP at Gen Con called Out of the Archives, but it's sold out. So I just wanted to brag about it.
Excellent.
And Craig, thanks for listening to us yap about feminine horror.
Thanks, Craig.
It was incredibly enlightening.
Thank also all of you. Thanks to our opening and closing theme song. Thank you, StepSax, for your song Avel, licensed under Creative Commons. And thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye.